We'd been standing at the top of the stair that led up to the Starhenge. I pushed the door open and we walked outside, squinting in the light. Cord had gotten a little testy. From watching Orlo talk to artisans like Fleck and Quinn, I knew how impatient they could be with what they saw as our winding and indirect way of talking. So I shut up for a minute and let her look around. We were on the roof of the Presidium, which was a great disk of stone reinforced by vault work. It was nearly flat, but bulged up slightly in the middle to shed rainwater. Its stones were graven and inlaid with curves and symbols of cosmography. Around its perimeter, megaliths stood to mark where certain cosmic bodies rose and set at different times of the year. Inside of that ring, several freestanding structures had been erected. The tallest of these, right in the center, was the pinnacle, wrapped in a double helix of external stairs. Its top was the highest part of the minster. The most voluminous structures up here were the twin domes of the big telescope. Dotted around from place to place were a few much smaller telescope domes, a windowless laboratory where we worked with the photomnemonic tablets, and a heated chapel where Orlo liked to work and to lecture his fids. I led Cord in that direction. We passed through two consecutive doors of massive iron-bound hardwood, the weather could get rough up here, and came into a small, quiet room that, with its arches and its stained-glass rosettes, looked like something out of the old Mathic age. Resting on a table, just where I had left it, was the photomnemonic tablet that Orlo had given me. It was a disk about the size of my two hands held side by side, and three fingers thick, made of dark, glassy stuff. Buried in it was the image of Sant Tancred's nebula, dull and hard to make out, until I slid it away from the pool of sunlight coming in the window. "That's about the bulkiest phototype I've ever seen," Cord said. "Is that like some ancient technology?" "It's more than that. A phototype captures one moment. It doesn't have a time dimension. You see how the image seems close to the upper surface?"
"Yeah."
I put a fingertip to the side of the tablet and slid it downwards. The image receded into the glass, following my finger. As it did, the nebula changed, contracting into itself. The fixed stars around it did not change their positions. When my fingertip reached the bottom of the tablet, the nebula had focused itself into a single star of extraordinary brilliance. At the bottom layer of the tablet, we're looking at Tancred's star on the very night it exploded in 490. Practically at the same moment that its light penetrated our atmosphere, Sant Tancred looked up and noticed it. He ran and put a photomnemonic tablet, just like this one, into the great telescope of his consort and aimed it at that supernova. The tablet remained lodged there, taking pictures of the explosion every single clear night until 2999, when finally they took it out and made a number of copies for distribution to the Thousanders. "I see things like this all the time in the background of spec fiction spielies," Cord said. "But I didn't realize that they were explosions." She traced her finger up the side of the tablet a few times, running it forward thousands of years in a second. "But it couldn't be more obvious." "The tablet has all kinds of other functions," I said, and showed her how to zoom in on one part of the image, up to its resolution limit. That's when Cord saw the point I was making. "This," she said, pointing at the tablet. "This has got to have some kind of SYNDEV built into it."
"Yes,
which makes it much more powerful than a phototype, just as your five-axis mill is much more powerful because of its brain."
"But isn't that a violation of your discipline?"
"Certain proxies were grandfathered in, like the new matter in our spheres and our bolts, and like these tablets."
"They were grandfathered in?
When?
When were all of these decisions made?"
"At the convoxes following the first and second sacks," I said. "You see, even after the end of the Praxic Age, the consents obtained a huge amount of power by coupling processors that had been invented by their syntactic faculties to other kinds of tools, in one case for making new matter, and in the other for manipulating sequences. This reminded people of the terrible events and led to the first and second sacks. Our rules concerning the ETA and which proxies we can and can't use date from those times." This was still too abstract for Cord's taste.
but suddenly she got an idea, and her eyes sprang open.
Are you talking about the incanters?
Out of some stupid, involuntary reflex, I turned my head to look out the window in the direction of the millenarian map, a fortress on a crag, on a level with the top of this tower, but shielded from view by its walls. Cord took this in. Worse, she seemed to have expected it. The myth of the incanters originated in the days leading up to the third sack, I said.
And their enemies, what do you call them?
Rutters.
Yeah, what's the difference exactly?
She was giving me the most innocent, expectant look, twirling her watch chain around her finger. I couldn't bear to level with her, to let her know what stupid questions she was asking.
If you've been watching those kinds of spielies, you know more about it than I do, I said.
One sort of glib explanation I heard once was that Redders could change the past and were glad to do it, but incanters could change the future and were reluctant. She nodded as if this weren't a load of rubbish.
Forced to by what the Redders had done.
I shrugged. Again, it all depends on what work of fiction you happen to be enjoying.
But those guys would be incanters, she said,
nodding at the crag.